It's Southside Chicago.
Okay, so first let me thank the organizers for having me here. It's been an incredibly valuable experience for students to be here, and especially for inviting me to give a talk. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is scalar fields, and in particular scalar fields that couple to matter. So before I do so, let me motivate why you would be interested in such a thing. Now, scalar fields are abundant in string and supergravity theories. Okay, of course, it's not new to anyone in this audience, I'm sure. However, the problem is that, in general, they couple directly to matter with gravitational strength. You may believe that that's not a problem, as gravity is weak. However, in this context, it is certainly a problem, and we get various difficulties, such as very large equivalence principle violations. The coupling constants can vary, and the masses of elementary particles can vary. Okay, so the idea is that a light scalar field that couples to matter with gravitational strength gives you a theory that disagrees with experiments. Okay, generally a bad thing. So, generally a bad thing. Depends on your field. Could be worse. So, what are the sort of approaches that people have taken to solve this problem? Well, you can suppress the couplings of the fields to matter themselves. This is work done in 1994 by Demur and Polyakov, using string loop effects. Okay, it's up there, called the least coupling principle. Another thing you could do is find approximate global symmetries to suppress these couplings, work done by Sean. But in 98. But what seems to be the general feeling is that the field somehow acquires mass. And by acquiring mass, it then only has very short-range interactions and doesn't cause any problems with experiments. And this is the type of approach that we've taken in this work. So, right. On the other hand, observations. Nice picture. Talks have to have pictures. So, we know from tons of observations, in fact, that we're undergoing accelerated expansion at the moment, and this tells us that we're in some kind of dark energy phase where pressure is negative. And although positive lambda is still possible, it's also interesting to ask the question, could there be some kind of quintessence? And for quintessence, we need a very light scalar field rolling very slowly over time. So from an observational point of view, scalar fields, in particular light scalar fields, are very interesting. On somewhat shakier ground, less strong footing, is the recent Webb data, bless you, that gives a variation of the fine structure constant from the absorption lines in quasar spectra. They found a measurement of 1 part in 10 to the 5 for delta alpha over alpha, over a redshift range of order of unity about. So this is generally, you know, maybe not so good because we think our constants should be constant, but it is possible that they may vary, and if this data is true, it would be fantastic to be able to explain it with a theory. So in general, observation suggests the existence of scalar fields evolving on cosmological timescales. And to evolve on cosmological timescales, they need to be very light. Okay, so what is the idea that I've come all this way to tell you about today? So the point of our work is that the mass of the scalar field can depend on the local matter density. Okay, and so what that means is that in a region of high density, such as the Earth where we live, the mass of the field is large, and so the equivalence principle violations are suppressed. On the other hand, in the solar system where the density is much lower, the field is essentially free, and we can make interesting predictions for equivalence principle violations. Even more interestingly, on cosmological scales, the density is very much lower, and the mass of the field could be of the Hubble, the size of the Hubble constant, and hence very, very, very light. It can evolve. Your field can evolve cosmologically. And so it is, in fact, possible that this field could be a candidate to explain the current acceleration of the universe. So everything depends on the fact that the mass of the field depends on the local matter density. So this should give you some indication as to why we call this chameleon fields or chameleon cosmology. Okay? Anyone who doesn't understand it, ask me, I'll explain it. Okay. So what is our approach? Well, we want the field to have cosmological effects, but of course, There should be no equivalence principle violations in the lab where we do our experiments. So we live in a dense environment, and so this should be the case. So what we'll do is use the experiments that have been done on Earth to constrain the parameters in our model, and then we'll take those constraints and use them to make predictions in space. People will go out and measure them and see if we're right or wrong. Okay? And they are doing so. In the next 10 years, 4 experiments that I know of are going to be making measurements that could say, you guys are wrong, go home, or you're right, people make more models. So
it's interesting. Philosophy.
It's not just philosophy, exactly. Okay. So going against the grain here into the Midwest of physics. And so afterwards you can ask, well, can this field have cosmological effects? And this, all of this we've done, and this is something that we're working on at the moment. We're looking at the cosmological effects then that the field can have. And if we make progress in the next month, you can ask me to give another talk. Okay, so a quarter of the way through, I'm going to give you the ingredients. So our action is as follows. It's fairly simple, non-minimally coupled scalar field. This audience should know that that's the reduced Planck mass. G is the Einstein frame metric. Psi's are your matter field, and they are conformally coupled to the Einstein frame metric, so they're in Jordan frame.
So the words non-minimally coupled, I mean, it's minimally coupled gravitationally.
Right, gravitationally, but to matter, exactly, right. So this is just your usual kinetic term, no 1 over r's, very simple. And we say fairly little about V. All we need is for the potential to be of the runaway form. So we don't require a priori a minimum or anything else. Okay, so let's look at the potential. So runaway form just means that as phi goes to infinity, v comma phi over v, etc., go to zero, and the inverse is true as phi goes to zero, etc. So you can see it's of a fairly simple form, and you can put whatever favorite potential you want. Ours happened to be the inverse power law, and so both of our papers are written with this example in mind. However, as I say, at the moment we're looking at different potentials to come up with more exciting cosmology. Because I'll tell you in advance, this one doesn't work. Okay, so
this one doesn't work for cosmology.
This one doesn't work for quintessence, and it won't give you varying constants. So the mass of the field turns out to be too large in cosmological scales. Okay.
I think your coupling, the coupling of matter becomes very strong when the potential becomes very, very small. Is it? How does it work? How do these
two slides? Two slides away, it'll work. Okay, so you can solve the equation of motion from the action, where rho I is the energy density in the ith form of matter. Looking at this, it's written in a sort of suggestive way. If you look at it for long enough, a whole second should do. You can see that, in fact, the dynamics are governed by an effective potential.
Is that rho really the trace of the energy momentum tensor?
No, good. So it's not. Okay, this rho is the rho that's conserved in Einstein frame. So there's no dependence on phi in there. If you actually do the trace of the energy momentum tensor, there's some e to the 3 beta phis, and there's more terms that come out.
I'm just asking if you had pressure also.
Right.
Would there be pressure in this on the right-hand side?
Well, in... No, I don't think so.
Yes,
I'm not sure what you're asking, setting. Right, but in general I guess it's easier in this case, because if I'm talking about general matter, then I don't have to worry about pressure. But if I'm worried about radiation, then yes.
Okay, then it would be
okay. Yes,
yeah. Okay. Yes. So it's the trace of the energy momentum tensor with appropriate factors of phi.
Exactly right. So with some e to 3 beta phi is right. So in this case, I don't have to worry about any other form of matter, because I'm going to only look now at sort of local physics,
the solar system,
right? Stuff that doesn't go on in this room. I'm going to look at the solar system. Okay, so an easier way of seeing this is just to look at any one dominated stage, where now I've gotten rid of the sum. That just looks prettier. Okay, so that's my effective potential that governs everything. And here's the picture that I think Rami wanted. So you can see now what's going on, how the two couple. Yes? So you can see now that in the large rho phase, where the potential has a minimum, the mass of small fluctuations about that minimum is much higher than in the small energy density phase. So if rho is much less, right? So the curvature here is less than the curvature here, okay? So think of C as that side and infinity as that side. It'll maybe make sense in a minute. On the other hand, the minimum on this side is at a much smaller value than the minimum here, okay? And so everything comes out of the effective potential. So all the features of our model come out of these two facts. So it's important that it's clear, right? Is clear? Okay, good.
When you,
yes.
Excuse me, I got a little confused earlier. When you said it's conformally coupled, but you don't have a coupling of the scalar to the curvature?
No. I guess you could, no.
She has a different definition of the word conformally coupled.
Right, you could, I mean, I'm just conformally coupling to matter, right? So the R term and the kinetic term and the V term are just, they're just coupled to the usual Einstein frame metric. However, the matter fields couple conformally.
It's not conformally invariant.
Right.
Right, but there's another fact, which is that conformal coupling is a function of the other interactions. So that in an interacting theory, it can't be zero except at one scale.
You mean the direct coupling of phi to r?
Phi squared r to phi squared r.
Yeah. This is all very classical.
Classical, I heard this before in another side. Classical actions result as an approximation to effective field theories that come from somewhere. And whether it's natural or not is a relevant question. Even though classically you can set constant zero arbitrarily. It isn't, you can assume it's small, but it isn't natural in interacting field theory.
I mean, at this stage, nothing's interacting, so we haven't let the...
you have this potential.
But the psi i's are not interacting with each other, right? Mm-hmm. So you're worried about the fields interacting, the phi interacting with the psi's?
I think Marty
the matter fields?
Phi squared r.
Conformal transformation, okay. Which takes away...
You can redefine that way.
You only define by conformal transformation of the metric.
You just work in the Einstein frame.
Well, we can...
Okay.
Isn't this equivalent to saying that quantum mechanics will renormalize the values of what she's calling beta i at any given scale? You can always do a scale-dependent conformal transformation.
As long as you're working wavelengths much larger than whatever the little scale of new physics is, then you can write the Lagrangian at this point.
We have it, shows up somewhere else.
In the beta i, so I think like Mark said.
Okay. So we can come back to that at the end, I guess. So train of thought. So okay, so if you wanted to look at some kind of object, some compact object, which you need to look at in discussing equivalence principle violations on the surface of the Earth, then, for example, the inside of the object, the Earth, is given by this plot, this graph, and the outside is given by this one, where the energy density is much lower. And so, very much inside the Earth, the value... sorry, this is on the outside. Very much inside the Earth, the value for the field is approximately at the minimum. So it starts off there, and very far outside, it needs to make its way here. Okay. So, as I said, you need to solve this compact object problem. And we make the following assumptions, which turn out to be fairly natural and are self-consistent. So you get the equation of motion from your action with the following boundary conditions. And rho here depends on which stage you're in. So if you're inside the Earth, then rho is the energy density of the Earth. If you're outside, then it's the energy density either of the atmosphere or of the surrounding gas. And so not only do you have the two boundary conditions, but you also have matching conditions, of course, at the surface. Now, even graduate students can solve differential equations. And we get following solution. Okay, so there's two kinds of solutions that you can get. And to think about it, okay, so to think about it, let me use some kind of intuition. So we use calculus as some way to picture what's going on. So very close to the inside of the object, the field is at the minimum. Okay, I'm going to go back. So this has to be zero at r equals zero. And so phi is approximately constant on the inside of the object. And very far out, it's also constant. So we need to find the behavior from the one to the other, how it rolls. And we find that, I have to use the blackboard, sorry. Okay. So if this is your object, then you want to look at the contribution of some little guy dv, some little element dv, to the field on the outside. And we find that only a ring, okay, or a shell on the outside of your object contributes to the field out here. And this is simply because the mass inside here is so much larger than the mass outside. When I say mass, I mean the mass of the field. Okay, it's so much larger inside here than outside. So any contribution due to that guy is going to go very quickly to zero. And so these inside bits don't contribute to the field on the outside. Okay, is this making sense? Good. And so we find that only some shell contributes. Now, how thick is this shell that contributes? Well, that's sort of the crux. And so we call this delta RC, and the whole thing is the radius of the object. Okay. And so in the case where this is small, so only a very thin shell contributes, we get the solution, okay? And so you get the what we call the thin shell condition, appropriately named. In the case where it's large, you get the simplest solution, where this term doesn't contribute. Okay, and all the features sort of come out of this. And this, I mean, I have to say, this came out of the math, right? The intuition really did come afterwards. So this came out of the math, and we had to think about what's going on, and this was seemed to be a good way to explain it. Okay. So when we model the Earth, we do something slightly more sophisticated in that we look at the Earth as being a solid object of density. What's the density of the Earth? 10 grams per centimeter cubed, roughly. And then we also look at the atmosphere on the outside. So we treat both the Earth, then the atmosphere, and then space, which includes sort of averaging of baryonic gas and dark matter. Okay, and
the density of the atmosphere really matters?
It does. It does. Okay. I'll show you why it does now. So it's important to know what this is and get some kind of physical intuition for what it is. So if you have some phi field in space, then you can think of it as transmitting a force or sending out a potential, which it does. And so you can see that phi c there is a Newtonian potential. So you can see that delta RC over RC is a way of comparing the potential of the field that the field sets up and the Newtonian potential. So an object that has a very large Newtonian potential, such as the Earth, the Sun, you know, big things, will give you a very small delta RC over RC. And hence we get this kind of thin shell effect on big objects like the Earth. A small object, like a baseball, has a very small Newtonian potential. And so delta RC of RC gets larger.
Large compared to what?
Large compared to this. So it is true that you need to then still calculate what the phi field gives you, right? But as a sense of numbers, right, the Newtonian potential for the Earth is about 10 to the minus 9, whereas for a baseball it's about 10 to the minus 27. So it's clear that delta RC of RC is going to be very small for the Earth relative to what it would be for a baseball. Okay.
Are you saying this delta RC itself is actually bigger for a baseball than for the Earth as well? You get a thicker shell that contributes for a baseball than for the Earth?
Exactly. So for a baseball, the whole shell could contribute. Right? So if we were doing experiments on top of a baseball out in space, then we're going to see completely different things to doing experiments on top of the Earth out in space. So that's exactly the point, right? So
if you put the baseball in a vacuum chamber?
Good, okay. Good, very important. No, it's a good question. And I'm just going to finish the slide and then I'm going to answer that question if that's all right. So this is what we call our thin shell effect. And the strongest constraint that we get comes from the fact that both the Earth and the atmosphere need to display this thin shell effect. If they don't, then we're already ruled out by present experiments. So we use present experiments to then constrain our model. Okay. And so the strongest constraint gives us that delta RE over RE needs to be less than 10 to the minus 7. And I'm going to use that later to give you numbers for our potential for our model. So let me go to the vacuum chamber because it's important. Any questions about this before I do so? No? Okay.
Sorry about
that. It's okay. Okay. So the vacuum chamber is an important issue because all the experiments that are done on the surface of the Earth are done within a vacuum. And so we do need to look at it. And what we found, we did this both numerically and on the blackboard. And what we found is that within the chamber, the field is approximately constant. Okay, and so the value that the field takes is given by, it's the value that minimizes the potential V here, where the mass is the size of the field. So RV there is the radius of the vacuum chamber. So if I have some chamber, sorry about this, if I have some chamber, everything's spherical in my world, of radius RV, then the Compton wavelength of your field is the size of this chamber. And once you fix that, because the mass of the field is given by the second derivative of the potential, once you've fixed this, you've fixed that, and then you fix phi, because this has got phi's in it. So that gives you the value for phi.
By the way, if I remember your paper, you take really rho equals 0 in the vacuum chamber.
Yes, absolutely.
But the best vacuum are pi minus 9 tau or something
right.
Like that. They are not so good, which is like high atmosphere.
I think the more...
Did you check that it's not...
Right, I think if there's more rho, then it's even more in our favor. So the idea is... keep changing slides. The idea is that the vacuum chamber doesn't, the argument for the vacuum chamber is not that much different than the argument we would use for a compact object, right? So in a compact object, this is an inverted potential. It's easier to think about it this way, right? Using R as T. So the idea is that the field needs to somehow get, it starts off at this minimum on the inside, it rolls, and then it needs to somehow make its way to the top here on the outside. But now in this case, for the vacuum chamber, you don't have rho. Say there's no rho. Then you just have this term. And so because it needs to ultimately reach matching condition at the surface of the chamber, it has to start in an area where it's friction dominated. And so by adding in some kind of rho, you're making it easier. So I think if the vacuum chamber is not a perfect vacuum, then in fact you're in better shape. So although the vacuum chamber was a big issue and we worried about it when we first thought about it, it turns out to actually just help the argument. So, right. So what do you want to ask me about the vacuum chamber?
No effect in vacuum chamber.
There is. So the issue with what happens in the vacuum chamber is, so we get two constraints. The two constraints that we get from data on Earth. The one is that delta RE over RE has to be less than 10 to the minus 7. And from this, the vacuum chamber also gives us another constraint because you have to think of the two things going on in the chamber, and they have to satisfy the experimental limits. They have to be, the Jatvas parameter has to be less than 10 to the minus 13. And so to satisfy that, it gives us a constraint on phi.
So the experiments in which you measure, in which you look for gravitational strength forces.
Right.
And there'll be experiments in which you measure the constants and look and see if they change.
Right.
Are you talking about both?
Those are different things. So at the moment, I'm talking about gravity.
Okay.
So the ones where you measure like constants varying in space,
right.
The Vassat-Levine experiment has the strongest data, and those are even easier to satisfy. So I'm talking about the ones that were the hardest for us to satisfy. And so in the sense that, I mean, I want to make clear that our philosophy is not, we have a theory, let's test it against all the experiments. It's, we have an idea, let's use those experiments to constrain our parameters and then make predictions. And so we use the ones that give us the strongest constraints. And the strongest constraints come from the Yatwash experiment in Washington, from having these two guys going around each other in a vacuum chamber, and from the fact that if the atmosphere and the Earth don't display thin shell suppression, then we get a Yotvos parameter that's too large as well.
Yeah, so you're getting a force if I only apply as a gradient. But sitting at a minimum, it's not going to give you a force.
Right, exactly, right. Good. Okay, let me go back to where I was. See, PowerPoint's not that bad. Okay. Effective potential compact object, yes.
Sorry, why did the FOH experiments give you anything? Because you just coupled through the metric, right? So you shouldn't get any fifth forces, no matter what the scale of you.
No, you do. You do get a fifth force. Right. Yeah, so all along, so far what I've done, I've assumed always that I've only worried about one beta there, right? But if you have two different types of matter, they'll couple differently. And so you'll have beta 1 and beta 2.
Okay,
and so
right.
They can experience. Right, absolutely, I agree with you.
Okay.
So throughout, we sort of assume we only worry about one, and then later on we generalize. So now's a good time to generalize. Okay, so as Joe was saying, if you have phi, then you have the gradient of phi that you need to worry about, and you get the following fifth force. And this gives you a potential for your two bodies. Okay, R here is the separation between your little particles. Beta 1 and beta 2 are the various ways that they couple, the scalar field couples to that form of matter. And so beta 1, beta 2 gives you the strength of your interaction. And the R vacuum is the range of the interaction. Okay, the reason we have R vacuum here is because the experiments that we want to compare with were done in vacuum chambers. So it's important to get that right. Okay. Now, the thin shell effect effectively turns beta into delta RC over RC times beta. So if those small bodies are undergoing some, are you know, experiencing this thin shell effect, then they no longer have this they no longer have this beta, they rather have some effective beta. And you can see that from the phi equation that is long gone. Okay, so when people do tests looking for fifth force, they use the same kind of Yukawa potential that we've derived, where here alpha again is your coupling, and lambda is the range of your interaction, and they null fifth force searches basically constrain lambda alpha parameter space. Okay, so the vacuum chambers that we're looking at are about the size of a meter, so they're about where there, and so the alpha that they get is about 10 to the minus 3. So we need to, that gives us the strongest constraint. And so beta 1 effective, beta 2 effective needs to be less than 10 to the minus 3. So because we've said beta is of order 1, you know, a priori, that means that these little test bodies need to undergo the thin shell effect for this to be suppressed, so that you get this effective beta.
Sorry, I think
right.
I didn't understand your previous explanation. This looks like it does not go away when the two betas are the same. So if the two betas are all the same, I can go to the Jordan frame,
yes.
Right? And then there's just a metric along whose geodesics I'm moving, and there's no such thing as a fifth force.
But it is short range, lambda.
Right.
Oh, so
I'm not sure that's the same question.
So maybe we're just defining the words fifth force differently. So this is
okay.
Not a composition dependent force. This is just. Right, so if the betas are all equal,
right,
then
the
composition is
finite.
Of course, but
that's the
okay.
Notion of people.
Okay. As long as you're both happy. So, so now having got all this data, we need to constrain the model parameters. The strongest, as I said before, the strongest constraint that we have is that delta RE over RE is less than 10 to the minus 7. Using this specific potential that we played with, gives us a mass scale of 10 to the minus 3 EVs, okay, which coincides with the energy scale of dark energy.
This comes from
highly coincidentally.
That FOSH experiment?
No. Just putting in this constraint and writing that is phi over 6 beta M Planck phi Newtonian, and then putting in, you know,
what
all the data.
This constraint is not satisfied.
We'll get a different M. I mean,
what is the experiment
if
to be that constraint?
Oh, this, yeah, this is yacht wash, basically.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, sure. Sorry.
What value right. Then? I get confused. What value then? This is for anybody.
Good. I didn't say. So that's taking n of order 1. So we used n about 2 to get that value. And it depends how you vary n, what your mass scale is. And in fact, since this doesn't work for quintessence, we've tried to do all kinds of things to n to make it work. But I'll leave that open.
It's slightly, also slightly different from quintessence because it, as the potential goes down, the matter coupling goes up and actually blows up if the betas are positive. Like e to the beta phi
right.
Goes to infinity in the region where the potential goes to zero.
Right, right. But if you think about the universe evolving, then this the rho term is slowly moving down, and so your scalar field can sort of track that minimum, and so the effective potential sort of goes down. Right? Does that draw it for you?
This means that the matter is coupled very strongly to quintessence in this form.
So, you know, it can start off there, but as this decreases, then this guy is slowly making its way down the minima, and it can slowly track. Okay. But, okay, so another way to look at this in terms of constraints is to look at the Compton wavelength of the field in various regions. So in the atmosphere, it's very small, so it's a millimeter. So if you wanted to test and see if we were right, you would have to do some experiment within a millimeter of the surface of the Earth, which is clearly why, you know, we're safe on Earth. But in space, you get a different case. So G there is meant to be our galaxy, and so the mass of the field, the wavelength of the field is can be anything up to about 10 to the 4 astronomical units, and cosmologically 10 to 3 parsecs. So I prefer to think about it in terms of energies. And so this is basically the same information, but if I wanted this to be able to explain dark energy, say, if I wanted this field, this potential, with everything we've done to work for on cosmological scales, this would need to be 10 to the minus 33 or less. So the mass is just too large on cosmological scales to give us what we want. Okay. So what predictions can we make? Well, the new feature that this model is bringing is saying that we have very different behavior in space compared to what we have on Earth. And so with that, we can make predictions. So the test for universality of freefall measure the Yatvas parameter, as I've said before, which is the difference in acceleration over the sum of acceleration of two bodies. The best limit comes from Yatvash, which is of less than 10 to the minus 13, very small. And we predict basically a range between 10 to the minus 11 and 10 to the minus 19, depending on beta. So beta is of order 1, so in which case 10 to the minus 11 is possible. That's a signal. Beta is larger, then we get an even larger signal. And although I don't know what is in the minds of people that design these experiments, I'm not sure that people really do expect to see a signal. But any signal, I think, would be very nice.
Didn't you say beta's
Beta's order 1.
I thought you said beta squared was limited to 10 minus 3.
No, that's beta effective. So there's some delta RC over RC effects going on there, and that has to be much less than 1.
You said beta 1, beta 2 is less than 10 minus 3.
There's a little effective on the bottom there.
Oh, effective.
Sorry. So, you know, if you're looking at all these kinds of forces, then you have beta e to the minus mr over r, right? Some Yukawa guy. And one way would be to suppress these betas, and that's work that's been done specifically by De Moore. And what we've done is trying to suppress m here. So so the whole point is to leave beta of order 1. If we have to make beta small as well, then I don't think that we've gained any ground. So beta, you know, we do effectively do both, yes, I agree. So we do achieve this, but through the mass.
And why
good.
Do you need to go to space? Can't you need a large region of low density, like a large vacuum chamber, and use the usual test for?
Good point. I mean, you could, I guess. And there are a few tabletop experiments that people...
But this would be a room.
Right, that would be a room. But there are even other experiments that people have suggested at the end of my collaborator's talk.
Does this region need to be for your experiment, for your predictions?
I don't know. I can't answer you that now. But I can tell you one good thing about this is that all these experiments are already being built and happening anyway. So they're taking this data anyway. So it would be nice if they find something. And this is, when I say near future, I mean within the next decade, next 5 years. So
PG is not a pool. Stereo is not a pool. Only microscope is a pool.
One of them, OK. So microscope is the French one, is the French project, correct? And GG is Italian. It's the only one that's approved.
In the planning.
In the planning stages. And STEP is NASA and...
2007.
Right.
Are any of these approved?
Microscope.
I thought you said planning.
I said microscope and the pool.
Right.
The pool. And the launch date is 2007.
Okay.
I think it would really be useful for you then to consider...
To consider local.
There are these experiments where you drop a mirror, for example, in...
No, no, but the accuracy is much lower. I mean, as soon as you go to space, you get 3 orders of magnitude. People have been working 10 years on space to go from 10 to 30 to 30, and they are not yet there.
Okay.
So, I mean, it would be less costly, but very difficult to reach anything.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's the basic idea of these experiments?
Okay. So they have so they have coaxial cylinders, and they track them as they go around the Earth, in orbit in the Earth, and how much they fall relative to each other, relative to the Earth. And the difference, as far as I could tell, between microscope and GG is just how the coaxial cylinders are orientated relative to the Earth, whether they're going sort of like this or like this. So they really seem very much to be covering similar ground, although they have different levels of accuracy. So that's the basic idea of them. And on the other hand, there's also the Sea Capsule, which is an American project.
International.
Oh, really? Okay.
There are Russians
in it. Okay. Well, I heard about the Sea project in Eritrea in May, and I think they were still in proposing stages there, so I don't believe that this is passed yet. But what they would do is have, again, two bodies falling relative to each other and relative to the Earth and measuring very similar sort of things. And so we use this as a nice example to discuss what kind of predictions we can make. I'm running for time. Good. Okay. And so to maximize the signal that we want to get, we want a signal, right? To maximize the signal, the bodies inside the capsule need to not undergo this thin shell suppression. And so putting that together with a constraint that we have, that delta RE over RE needs to be less than 10 to the minus 7, this constraint that the C capsule is not thin shell suppressed gives you delta RE over RE needs to be greater than 10 to the minus 15, which translates into a large region of parameter space for this to work. So we can still mess around a fair amount of N and beta, and this can still work. Okay, so the force that would be measured is as follows. We now have gotten rid of the reduced Planck mass. So you can see G in its all glory. And if beta 1 and beta 2 are of order 1, as we would like them to be, then we're making some prediction that gives a correction of order 1 to Newton's constant. Okay, which is large. What do I want you to take away from here? Million fields are nice because there are no equivalence principle violations on Earth by construction. Okay, the way that we build up the models, it's to make sure that this is satisfied. We can then make predictions for experiments in space. We like theories that make predictions, and this does. And finally, they may have interesting cosmological consequences that are being looked at the moment, both by myself and our old collaborators, and by new people. There seem to be new things coming out, which is exciting. So, in fact, Sean's student is looking at some cosmological consequences. So, yeah. So I will leave you with some South African humor to convince you that we do have some good physics. Physics is penetrating culture worldwide. I know how much everyone hates to have a really short talk.
Oh, yeah.
So,
any more questions?
Are you learning anything about these models by considering solar system tests of GR?
We did consider them, and the solar system tests of GR are even easier to satisfy because everything that you're dealing with then is a very large body, and so they all, you know, would feel this thin shell suppression, and so they're not a problem. But we did consider them, yes. Good.
Okay. So the fifth one is magnetic matter. Is that is some microscopic point of view, particle physics point of view between the part the field phi and matter?
No, we haven't. Not at all. I mean, it's very sneaky in the sense that we just let it couple generally, and all the features don't really, they don't really matter whether it's coupled to neutrons or what it's coupled to. So. Yes.
How come you forgot the slide advertising last
week? Well,
never explained that.
You have to give a talk next week, and if you give a talk next week, then you can advertise it. So,
anything else?
That's it.
Let's thank Amanda again.